really enjoyed the show. I just apologise to the people who made the hubbub disturbing their afternoon experience. I'll tell you a little bit about the history of the show, and then I'll let you ask me questions if you have any. I've been working as a light artist for a little bit longer than I've been working as a musician. So the first light piece I made, I was 17 years old. And in fact, though it was a very simple piece, it actually contained many of the ideas that all of my later musical and visual work has contained. And I guess the primary idea is the idea of generating variety and change through combination of elements, continuous recombination of elements. Now, in music, I did that with my ambient records, music for airports and so on, really very simple initial materials which are allowed to recombine and cluster in unpredictable ways, so that the final output is a continuous stream of changing material. So this puts you in a rather different position as a composer, because you can't possibly have a conception of the finished piece in your head. All you can do is start the piece. And one of the things I shall talk about on Sunday evening is the idea of this new view of the artist as somebody who starts something rather than somebody who finishes something. So this really is an exact parallel to the kind of music that I've been doing. They develop together. They're not synchronized, but they come from the same place philosophically. What happens with this piece that you've seen here is that basic banks of images are chosen from randomly, and then they're laid on top of one another. That's the simplest way of stating what happens. So there are three computers running there. Each one has four screens as its output. And each computer is running the same piece of software and randomly choosing from all of the images that it has in its bank, which is not that many actually. There are about 400 images in two of the computers and about 60 in the third one. So there aren't many initial primitives, we call them, but the number of combinations that can make is 77 million per computer, which of course means that the real title of this show should be 77 million cubed. You've got three computers. But that number would be so long that I'm afraid this museum isn't big enough for a number like that. You have to extend the front of the museum. So in very brief terms, that's how the piece works. It's to do with combinations, and it's to do with the idea of this thing that I call generative. I came up with this idea of generative art about 20 years ago. It wasn't an original idea. A lot of other people have been working in a similar form, but I gave it a name, as I gave ambient a name. So giving something a name is, in a funny way, a way of making it real and making it distinct. When you name something, you sort of create it as well. By generative, what I mean is some kind of systems approach to making art, where essentially what you're doing is creating a kind of conceptual machine which then keeps producing stuff. Now, the success of this for me is that I still sit in these shows for hours on end, because I'm as surprised by the results as anybody else is. So of course I know all the original images, I made all the original images, many of them by hand, drawn at a very small scale. But I don't know the combinations, and in fact I've never seen the same combination twice. And I must have watched this stuff for many thousands of hours now. So I'm kind of fascinated by the power of combinatorial mathematics, and slightly worried that painters might come here and leave with their head in their hands as they watch more paintings than they could do in a lifetime go past in half an hour. It's probably slightly discouraging for them. However, the advantage they have is that they're staying. Mine disappear. Once it's passed, you won't see it again. So there's a slightly sad note in the whole thing as well. My feeling about why this work exists, why it's worth doing, is because I think it takes, certainly it takes my mind, and apparently it seems to take other people's minds, to a place that it doesn't normally go in the kind of life that we live at the moment. It's slightly religious, perhaps. You know, it's not dissimilar to the feeling I was having last weekend when I was sitting in Ely Cathedral in Lincolnshire in England. Enormous cathedral with the most beautiful stained glass windows, and a place where people come and sit still. Probably some of them are praying, but I would imagine quite a lot of them are. They're just enjoying the place where you can be in a space and surrender to it. And the idea of surrender is a big part of this for me. The idea of making something which says to you, allow yourself to be out of control. Just go with it for a while. I like that feeling. I think it's a primary human urge to have that feeling. That's, I believe, why we have sex, drugs, rock and roll, and religion. Because we like surrendering. And so I see this as a way of giving people a beautiful place to surrender in. There was a rather snotty review in the LA Times by an art critic. Bagel is his name?
Bagel.
David Pagan. I mean, it's the kind of review I do sometimes get from art critics. And I was thinking about this last night, and what I think is the sort of misapprehension there. I was saying to Chris this morning, it's a little bit like a guy comes along and he builds a bridge and it connects the mainland where everyone lives to a very pretty island where they all like going, and everyone uses the bridge and they love going to the island and has a great time. And it's a big success. Then an architecture critic comes along and he looks at the bridge and he says, there's nothing very original about this bridge. I know many bridges that are much more interesting than this. But he doesn't look at what the bridge is doing. I'm not really concerned where this stuff fits in the story of art history, however that happens to be told at the moment. But I am concerned about making something that is of use to people, actually, of some kind of spiritual, even therapeutic use to people. So that's all I'll say right now, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Is the software, can you actually submit primitives into the software that you've created yourself? I mean, like...
Can you?
Yeah.
Well, I'd be very grateful if you offered me something. It isn't set up to do that. Mm-hmm. But I have, for some time, been thinking that there are certain artists who could use this and whose work would suit this very well. In fact, there's a Los Angeles artist who I like very much, who I think would love this system. His name is Larry Pittman. I could imagine that his work, if he entered his images into this, instead of mine, to generate endless Larry Pittman combinations, I think it would be a wonderful thing. There's an artist in England, Chris Ophelia, who I've been talking to about doing the same thing. So really, what you see here are two distinct things. There's the invention of the software that makes this thing happen, and then there's my images.
Right.
So you can separate my images and put somebody else's there. But it isn't set up so that the user who's bought the software can put images in. We might do that on a future...
Version 3?
Can you talk a little bit about that? This whole convergence of technology, creative, the traditional art, music, I mean, it's all sort of coming together from a lot of different disciplines, and where do you think this is going?
Well, I think one of the things that's very interesting is this widening of the lens. As I was telling with the metaphor of the guy with the bridge, I think what are called the fine arts have traditionally concerned themselves with the bridge and how it's made. And it's not an unimportant thing, by the way. That's the development of the kind of grammar of the language that the rest of us use. But we're the ones having the conversations, actually. The conversation is different from the development of the grammar. And the conversation is all over the culture. You know, everybody can be part of it. So I think that, of course, the fine arts always protect their patch very carefully because they know they're under threat. They know there's a lot of people coming up who are doing interesting things that actually are popular as well. I was just talking to my friend John Hassel, a musician who lives here in Los Angeles, and he said something very, very nice. He said, in the world of entertainment, to be called artistic is a compliment. In the world of art, to be called entertaining is a curse. That's absolutely on the mark.
Would it work if your original drawings were figurative?
Some of them are, but not very many. There are a few in there that come up occasionally. But I think the problem with using a lot of figurative images is that they demand a pictorial space, which probably would become very confusing and problematic in a way. The other thing about figurative images is that they start to become narrative, I think, if there's a sequence of them. And I don't want this to be narrative. I think one of the successes of it is that it isn't narrative. And it's, to me, very interesting to see this completely new form of viewer behavior where people come in, sit down for sometimes 2 or 3 hours, come back day after day and do it, and there's nothing going on. It's very slow, there's no story, there's no direction, there's no payoff, actually. So all the conventional things that we associate with sitting in theaters looking at things aren't there. I remember when I made music for airports, one of the reviews said, there's no melody, there's no beat, there's no story, it just listed all the things there weren't. And I thought, okay, that's quite a success. leaving things out is one way of moving forward, actually. Leaving out things that everybody thought you had to have there is one way of doing it. So the sense of narrative was something I didn't want there, really. I wanted it to be sort of steady state, relentless beauty.
Well, it's very trance-like.
Sorry?
It's very trance-like.
Yes,
it's meditative. So. It's hypnotic.
Well, I just before you all came, there was an elderly couple from Pennsylvania. They were on holiday here because their children live here. And I noticed they were sitting in there for a really long time, and I heard the children saying rather worriedly to the parents, "You okay, Dad? You want to come in?" Dad's saying, "No, leave me, I want to stay a bit longer." Anyway, they came out, and Dad says, "You know, I've never really liked art, but that's the best thing I've ever seen." So I find that a success, that it does something for people that they simply don't expect, mm-hmm. I think.
I have a question connected to Music for Airports, because I remember...
To what, sorry?
Music for Airports. Because about, I don't know if they still have them, but about 20 years ago, if you went into any airport, there were these non-denominational chapels.
Yes,
that were set up in a very similar way to this.
Yes.
So I was wondering what the connection was with the airport culture that you've been linked to, and also how much your church going upbringing reflected your desire to do something that looks very much like a stained glass, like a non-denominational stained glass.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think that's a very acute question, because for sure, I'm sure my early experience as a Catholic prior to becoming a militant atheist has left its mark on me. And I think that the thing about airports that's interesting is that they're sort of a weird transitory state that people are in. I don't know whether you have this experience, but when I watch movies on airplanes, which is actually just about the only place I do ever watch movies now, I find I'm incredibly open to being moved by them. So even the stupidest Goldie Hawn film, I can be in tears. And it's as if that the fact that you're unrooted, you're not in touch with anything on earth, and there's this sort of slight possibility in the back of your mind that you might die as well. I think all of those things make you emotionally open in a different way. And so I think the reason I was attracted to the Music for Airports project was because I thought this is a place where people are already in a different frame of mind. I was imagining, of course, that it would be played at airports, and it has been played at a few, but not that many. And I suppose I'm thinking of trying to make that frame of mind, the frame of mind where, you know, I always thought the problem with the music that you hear on airplanes and in airports is that the secret message is, don't worry, you're not going to die. Nothing's going to happen. It's all going to be fine. The music was so sort of ridiculously cheerful. And I thought it would be nice to make music that sort of said to people, would it really matter if you died? Sorry, you can ask that.
Yes, you've spoken today and earlier times about your interest in random results. I think this exhibition speaks to that. Can you discuss how you bring that to bear in your production work with various artists? And what I would perceive to be the inherent limitations, you know, you talk about coming here and not being able to see anything over and over again, but in your work as a producer, obviously there is that finished thing, as much as one can listen to it and hear different things, at some point, isn't there sort of a finality to that?
Yes.
How do you reconcile that?
At some point, somebody says, sigh, I've got to release this damn thing. That's usually me. I think that the point of using randomness is that it makes you make decisions that are beyond your good taste, and that's what's really interesting about it. So you can very easily, as a working artist, get into quite restricted taste areas. You know, you get that sound, you always do that sound with it, or you always do the same things, sort of thing. They're habits, everybody does it. But the point of using an amount of randomness is that suddenly you're confronted with something that you would not have done. And sometimes it's so extraordinarily better than you would have done. Mm-hmm. So you just pay attention and try to learn from the randomness. But the way I work with, when I'm working with bands, I try it in different ways of making arbitrary compositions, for instance. So we're going to jam, but bar 17, we're going to do something dramatically different from what we've been doing until then. And then on bar 19, you're going to choose whether to continue playing or not. Mm-hmm. And you're going to make the same decision again on bar 24 or whatever. So it just gives a way of creating structures that take you outside of the normal ones that you would by habit fall into. It's really, in production work, it's really more a way of exploring the possibility space than a way of generating finished results. It's practice, it's exercise, you know.
Do you have some desire that since most of that, I'm presuming, still exists somewhere and was rejected for the album release, do you have in your head the idea that wouldn't it be great if some of those mistakes or, quote, rejections were available to people?
There aren't many things that I feel the world would benefit from knowing about. I think music is a little bit like sausages and politics. You don't want to see it being made, really. It's a filthy business. Full of vile compromises.
Talk about your investment of thousands of hours in reviewing the 77 million paintings. Is the gallery setting the perfect or ideal setting to see the installation? And we talked a little bit about how you view it yourself. And are there limitations to any gallery space?
Well, the only limitation with galleries is that people think you're playing in the art world. That's the only limitation. And that means they start looking at the bridge instead of the journey, in terms of my earlier metaphor. I don't particularly mind, because it's really only art critics who do that. And they are a small minority of the population, luckily. The strengths, of course, of doing it in galleries is that galleries learn how to look after things and have a standard of excellence about how they do things. I'm also very happy to work in other kinds of spaces. I had a show in Naples, for example, which was at the end of a Roman tunnel. It was a tunnel built through a mountain so that the Romans could quickly move forces to the harbour. So they just drove right through the mountain. And it's a tunnel about as high as this beautiful arch. And it runs in a straight line for, it's about a kilometre, isn't it, Nick? Something like that. It's very long. So in that case, we had one of these pieces right at the end. So when you enter the tunnel, you just saw a tiny little star. And then you just walk towards it. So that was very nice. And we've done shows in a few odd spaces like that.
Had you noticed the pyramid out on the
campus? I love that pyramid.
It would service the pyramid perfectly.
Yeah, no, that's a beautiful piece of architecture, I think. I really love it. It's so straightforward and simple, but its relationship to the sky color is beautiful.
Because I really do see the installation as like public, like dominating public space, not just gallery space, but
I'm always thrilled when people wander in who don't normally go to galleries. That's the triumph for me, getting new converts, like a drug dealer. but I really enjoyed the speaking to that elderly couple today. That was so nice for me. That was great. And I like the fact that there's a lot of traffic passing here, students passing by, and I hope they'll wander in.
What's in Brian's MP3 player and why?
I didn't, sorry.
What's in your MP3 player? What's between currently in your...
I have been listening a lot lately to a boxed set called Goodbye Babylon, which is 6 CDs of early 20th century American religious music, black and white music, so it's got those Norfolk a cappella quartets, and it's got country singers and church services and everything. It's the best compilation I've seen for years, and it comes with a fantastic book, and I find that so intriguing that I just keep listening to it again and again. So the only other thing I've been listening to lately with enthusiasm is an English band called Leisure Society. I don't know if they've even released here yet.
October.
Is it?
October 14th.
Oh,
okay. It's now called Sleeper.
Sleeper, yeah. It's such a beautiful album. It's just such a nice record to listen to. But I don't listen to that much music, you see, because if you're making it, you can't really listen to it. It gets in the way. People who listen to most music are graphic designers, I have found. Most of the graphic designers I know are incredibly musically literate and can tell you all about all the new records and bands that are out. Because that's all they do all day. They sit and listen to music when they work.
You currently work with Underworld, didn't you, a little bit?
Yeah. Well, Carl Hyde, yes.
How was that experience? Electronic music, yes.
I like Carl. I think he's one of the great lyricists. So I worked with him really as a lyricist more than anything else.
Where are your politics on the geometric shape and nothing else?
Sorry, what did you say?
Where are your politics on the geometric shape and nothing else?
Yes, the middle-sized screens, they're always geometric, yeah. It doesn't have to be that way. It isn't always that way. Sometimes we change around what's on the screens, but what does seem to work is two panels of organic, if you like, and one panel of geometric. But they don't have to be those particular ones.
But do you always have one geometric?
Yes. Well, we have in the last few shows, haven't we? The last six or eight shows, I guess. Yeah.
The configuration of the screen, does that change different time from insulation?
It's sort of kind of stabilized lately. Uh-huh. So in the earliest shows like this we did, there was a period of mad experimentation where the screens were in all sorts of different ways. And in fact, some of the early shows used a lot more screens. There was a show in the Baltic Exchange in near Newcastle in England, which had 28 screens in five groups, wasn't it, I think? Five different groups. So, and then there was another show that had one very complicated group with 24 screens in or something like that. But this seems to satisfy me most, this, because I also like the space that it leaves in the middle with that flat coloured panel. That always seems a good counterpoint to the rest of it. And then I take that colour and,
yes, and the mountain,
yes, illuminate the little mountain in front of it as well. Yes. So I like this thing. One of the things that has been different from show to show is the way in which we've brought the show out into the room. So we've used these cones. Other times we've used tree trunks or false tree trunks to sort of populate the room a bit, so it doesn't feel quite like just sitting and looking at a flat surface, but that you're within a landscape of some kind.
Have you ever thought to revisit what you did using the sense of smell and bring different sensory experiences together?
Smell is very difficult to work with. I've been working with smell as an amateur perfumier for a very long time. I haven't kind of chaotic laboratory in my studio. And I'm very interested in smell. But the problem with using it in an installation situation is that you can't change it easily, unless you have vast air conditioning systems. Smell lingers, and it gets into the fabric of things, you know. So I tried it in Paris years ago. I had a show which had a smell with it. But it got cloyed, and it wasn't very successful. I never tried it again.
Is scratch and sniff too crude or something like that?
That's a thought.
Can we be expectant?
Sorry, you would, I think. Did you? Oh, you, sorry.
You know, well, it, almost everything you say, I feel some relationship to. I am a painter. And I did feel this regret that I couldn't figure out how you did it when I came here the first time. But I especially love the idea, the notion of creating space in the forest where every person could feel this wonderful Alice in Wonderland experience and be their own stage, you know, in their own hearts. It's a comment, not a question.
Okay, thank you.
Practically covered everything so beautifully, and without the use of the word infinite.
I forgot that, yes. Don't worry, I'll get it in the next sentence, which will be infinitely long. one of the things I have to say, actually, is that this installation was built by the gallery, of course. They built it all before we came here to plans that were sent. And many of the people building it were students here. And I think they did a fantastic job. You can't see the woodwork. Round the back, it looks great. It's beautifully made.
The works on the wall in this room, how were they produced?
They're single screens, basically. So they aren't actually photographed from the screens. They're remade. So, you know, we've got lots of photographs of the screens in action. And what has occasionally happened is we pick one out and said, okay, let's remake that, because better than using a photograph of the screen is to take the primitives and relayer them, if you like.
They were remade by hand, then?
Yeah, they're relayed. Well, by hand in the sense that somebody was clicking a mouse. That's a hand. So they're relayed in the computer.
Did you use the sort of same planting a seed idea when you created the primitives for the life?
Well, they started a very long time ago. Some of the images in this work are over 20 years old now, because the way this piece really started was I started using slide projectors. I'd been working with video for a while, and the problem was the limitation was the size of screen. I wanted something bigger than that, so I started using slide projectors, and I was using a program called Dataton, which was one of the clumsiest programs ever invented, to control the slide projectors, which would frequently jam and go wrong. But nonetheless, I was making slides, mostly by hand and directly on the slide. So a lot of those are hand-painted 2 inches square, actually. And then I would have the projectors running, and I would see how the slides look together. And of course, I couldn't see all the combinations, but after a while, you get a feel for the kinds of slides that tend to work well together and the kinds of slides that don't. And for instance, this is where the thing about figuration became clear to me that you couldn't have too much figuration, because you've got awkwardly contrasting spaces, mm-hmm. and it started to get into a weird sort of dimensionality that didn't work very well. So over the years, I would just sit in shows as I was setting them up, and I always had a table with a light box and all my new slides, and I tried them out, take a few of the old ones out. So we stopped using projectors really about 6 years ago, I think. That was the last time I think I used projectors was at the Hayward Gallery in London. And then one night I was walking home from my studio in Notting Hill, and I looked through somebody's window, and there was a dinner party going on in quite a posh house. 12 people around the table, and on the wall where there would normally have been a painting in the past, there was a big plasma screen. Mm-hmm. But of course it was black, because what do you play at a dinner party? So I thought, this is a new cultural niche. This is somewhere that hasn't been occupied, really. And so then I sort of thought back to the shows I'd been doing. And then, very luckily, I met Nick and Dominic, my brother-in-law. They're the two principals of the company, Lumen. And we found a way to digitize them and to turn it into a screen-based computer program. So it migrated away from projectors to computers. And that was a very good move, because whereas projector technology is all falling apart now, computer technology is getting better. So it's going in the right direction. Shall I take a couple more questions, or there may not be a couple more questions? In fact, there are. Good.
Can I ask you a little bit about your relationship with Edge? And there's the documentary that just came out, you might get mad, where he kind of reveals his technology and kind of pulls away the veil.
I wish I had spotted it there.
What is it like for you when you guys hang out with music? I mean, you guys, it must be a challenge.
It's a biographical question. I don't do biographical questions. I'm just not interested in talking about my life. You know, there's nothing interesting to say, basically, that's why. I'm good at talking about ideas, but I'm hopeless at talking about life, everyday life, and how I hang out with my friends and that sort of thing. I just don't. I'm very boring, basically, that's why. Obviously, ideas might be interesting, but I am so boring, you fall asleep in 5 minutes in a car.
Anytime you and Andrew hang out, I'll hang out with you. There you go.
Sure. Do you have one more question?
Yeah.
One last question.
In your gender business, do you hope people will see the leaders or the roles, or do you just expect them to see what's rendered?
What was the very last word you said?
What's rendered? Like, would you like those paintings to be perceived just as each of these rendered, or do you think people will imagine the roles or absence of roles in this case? That
well, I like people to start to get a feeling for how it's done. How the trick is done. I like revealing tricks. I don't have any wish to keep it secret. I like the fact that people can. That's why I'm happy to explain it, because I think it's a sort of miracle that combinatorics works in that way. So, on the other hand, I don't think it's necessary to know it. I'm quite happy too for people to come in and sit down and just wonder what's going on, and or not wonder what's going on. I mostly want to have a nice experience, you know, which is why I have comfortable seats. A breakthrough in gamma reception. You know, if you look at the way most people use gamma rays, they go like this. They walk towards a picture, and they look at the picture quickly again, and then they. Most of the time is spent on reading. It's really true. I've watched them in the National Gallery, so it's sort of like collecting, you know. I've seen them all, collecting them. And I deliberately want none of that to happen in there. So I don't want any information in there, but I'm happy to give as much as I can elsewhere, if you see what I mean. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
So come Sunday night, 7 o'clock, to hear Brian's full presentation at the Carpenter Center. You can take it to the Carpenter Center. Thank you.